From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So what happens now to the more than 150 Central Americans who've been camped out on the U.S.-Mexico border, many for about a week? They are what remains of the 1,200 who started out in a caravan over a month ago, fleeing what they said was violence in their home countries, seeking asylum in both Mexico and now the U.S. But the San Diego border crossing is at capacity. Jean Guerrero is immigration reporter at KPBS in San Diego. Jean, you were at the border yesterday. What's happened to these migrants?
When they arrived at the port of entry, they were met by Mexican police and army and immigration officials who stopped them in their tracks. I believe they had received word from U.S. Customs and Border Protection that the ports were at capacity and wanted to make sure that this huge group of 200 people didn't end up going into the port of entry. So they told them that a small group of people could go in and double check. And so that's what happened. About 50 people went through the gates, but when they reached the port of entry, Customs and Border Protection told them that they couldn't let them in, that they had no more space or resources to process additional people at that time.
Well, let's remind people, this is an organized caravan. They said they did organize it as a caravan to protect those in it. It had the help of immigration activists all along the way and was met by activists, you know, as they came to the border. You spoke with Alex Mensing of the advocacy group Pueblos Sin Fronteras.
We wish that the United States government were capable of accepting more than a few hundred asylum seekers at any given time, since we can certainly pick up more than 1,000 people in an ICE raid on any given day and deport them. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Hopefully someday that is the case.
So, Jean, what do you see happening here? What do activists and advocates want to have happen? What's possible?
So basically, they camped out last night, and I haven't heard back from U.S. Customs and Border Protection or the Department of Homeland Security as to what kind of resources they sent and why it is that just before the caravan arrived, they ran out of space. But it looks like they're just going to be waiting, and they're hoping that they're going to be able to trickle in slowly.
Meanwhile, there have been critics of the entire process. This morning, the hosts of Fox and Friends said these immigrants looked healthy. Even a pregnant woman scaled a sheet metal fence over the weekend. The host said the migrants are lawyered up. On the other side, there are people worried because there are children in the group. There were some couples with children who hadn't been married yet who got married right there at the border, knowing that they might all be separated. What's the sense of what will happen? Will they take the children and at least get them food and housing? What will happen?
It's really unclear at this point. They were hoping that at least the most vulnerable among the group would be allowed to enter the port of entry. There was one woman in a wheelchair who was put at the front of the line, but she also is still waiting. So it's very unclear. One thing that is expected to happen is if these caravan members are taken into custody, what they were told by immigration attorneys is that it's very likely that they'll be separated from their children. We have seen an increase in cases of immigration and customs enforcement separating families. The Department of Homeland Security had said last year that they planned to do this, to separate families in custody as a way of deterring more people from coming. So a lot of the families who I spoke with about this potentially happening to them said, you know, we are very frightened about this potentially happening to us, but at the end of the day, we would prefer our children to be safe from the violence that we're fleeing, even if it means that we're separated.
Well, there was a Health and Human Services Department report last week finding that the agency lost track of nearly 1,500 migrant children from Central America that they'd placed with sponsors last year. They had shown up alone at the border. So we'll keep an eye on that. But meanwhile, you were there. What is your sense of whether these people are fleeing violence or, you know, are healthy, lawyered up people?
One of the reasons that these caravans are organized is because there are increasing reports of people, of asylum seekers being turned away at the border. So the reason that one of the reasons that they join these caravans is because they hope that with the media attention and with the workshops that they receive from immigration attorneys, they'll be better prepared to deal with whatever happens when they come into contact with Border Patrol. But one of the things that's interesting is, you know, the Trump administration is is depicting this caravan as a caravan of people who intend to enter the U.S. illegally. We did have reports from Border Patrol that some members of the caravan entered illegally over the weekend before the organized effort to present themselves at the port of entry. The caravan themselves have distanced themselves from those people, saying, you know, we can't control everyone. And if people decide to separate from the caravan and cross the border on their own, there's nothing we can do about that. But the immigration attorneys who I spoke with mentioned that the reason a lot of asylum seekers cross the border illegally and jump the fence, for example, and risk their lives and the lives of their children is because of the fact that at the ports of entry where they typically present themselves to ask for asylum, they're being turned away.
That's Jean Guerrero, immigration reporter for KPBS in San Diego. Jean, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the price of Bitcoin is under $10,000 today, a far cry from where it was late last year, almost $20,000. And when that happened, an influx of entrepreneurs and developers scoured North America in search of cheap hydropower for Bitcoin mining. Many zeroed in on Washington State and upstate New York, where hydropower is plentiful. But now some cities, counties, and utilities are hitting the pause button because of these new electricity hogs. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network reports from Wenatchee, Washington.
You'd hardly guess without inside info that cryptocurrency fortunes are made and lost here on the edge of East Wenatchee. The best giveaway that something big is going on are the massive cooling fans. That's the nonstop 24/7 clatter and hum that maybe you can hear a little in the background. The fans are cooling specialized computer chipsets just packed to the brim inside modified cargo containers in front of me, or just a little ways down the road inside of huts.
There is a huge emerging technology opportunity for this region to maintain a first mover advantage in this technology space.
Malachi Salcido runs Salcido Enterprises in Wenatchee. He's developed several of these Bitcoin mines, which are all about computing power rather than digging minerals. The digital miners earn cryptocurrency, virtual money, for processing and recording global network transactions 24/7. But each day, just one of Salcido's large-scale data centers consumes about as much electricity as 9,000 households, which is why Bitcoin miners are drawn to places like the Wenatchee Valley. Dams on the Columbia River generate cheap hydropower, so electric rates are rock bottom. Plus, the climate is mild, helpful for efficient cooling, so operating costs low. But cities and counties in north-central Washington seem unsure whether to embrace this new line of energy-guzzling business. They worry about being overwhelmed and tapped out.
Good evening, everybody.
In the past month and a half, the Wenatchee City Council and four other smaller nearby cities all passed emergency zoning controls or outright moratoriums on cryptocurrency operations.
Roll call this evening. We have five members here. And
much of this action was spurred by the local electric utility, which has its own moratorium on processing new hookups for large loads. That's happened in rural western Washington State and Plattsburgh, New York, too. Andy Wendell with the Chelan County Public Utility District has questions for local governments.
We're not sure exactly how much of the cryptocurrency that the community would like us to serve, and so that's one of the major questions that we want, is how much do you want? And if you do want it in your community, where do you plan for it?
Wendell says the specialized data centers that process and record virtual currency transactions suck electricity big time, and there's only so much spare electric capacity left.
The cryptocurrency applications, many of them that we're getting, are taking up all of the remaining capacity in distribution circuits that were designed to bring on schools and housing and other commerce, other organic growth.
Chelan County Commissioner Keith Gaynor says it makes sense to take a time out before getting overwhelmed.
We hope we're on the front end. We don't want to play defense and come, you know, in a reactive mode. We'd rather be proactive.
Lately, business representatives have appeared before Wenatchee Valley elected officials to plead for more flexibility as government tries to tame the Bitcoin boom.
This moratorium has really put me in a bad spot.
Nick Martini of Half Moon Bay, California, wants to open a small Bitcoin mine in Wenatchee.
I'd like to go into this experiment, and I think do something that will actually be beneficial for Wenatchee, but I'm in a situation where I can't really win. And so what I'm asking is for the board to consider a more flexible approach.
Bitcoin miner Malachi Salcido says the local governments and utilities should be careful not to kill a goose that lays golden eggs.
If the policies are too onerous, or if they take too long to develop and implement, this development opportunity will go elsewhere.
Salcido says a $100 million expansion he had in the works in Chelan County will now likely be delayed because of the moratorium on new large load hookups. He says he'll redirect that Bitcoin data center investment to another western state instead, but wouldn't say where. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonds.
South Korea said today it will remove its propaganda broadcasting loudspeakers from the border with the North. The decision coming after Friday's historic meeting between the leaders of the two Koreas. At that meeting, North Korea's Kim Jong-un and South Korea's Moon Jae-in agreed to work toward a nuclear-free peninsula. Joining us now to discuss that and more is retired four-star General Jack Keane, former Army Vice Chief of Staff and Chairman of the Institute for the Study of War. He's with us from Washington. General, welcome to Here and Now.
Glad to be here.
And what do you think of what's going on in North Korea? Do you believe that Kim Jong-un is really willing to give up his nuclear weapons?
Well, I think he's doing everything that he can to convince us of that. I mean, he began sort of what I call a diplomatic blitz, beginning with inviting himself to the South Korean Olympics, then having his sister invite Moon to the president of South Korea, to a summit. And when the officials came to prepare for that summit, he disclosed to them that he would like them to carry a message to President Trump that he wants to meet with him. He has a meeting with Pompeo, which I believe is a pivotal meeting for the Trump White House, because I spoke to Director Pompeo on the subject of North Korea before he launched, you know, to his meeting. Certainly he never disclosed to me he was going to meet with Kim Jong-un. But this much I do know: the Central Intelligence Agency, more than anybody in our government, clearly has profiled Kim Jong-un. They have the best read on who he is, and he believes Kim Jong-un is a rational actor. So whatever he told Pompeo, I believe when he debriefed the president of the United States, he gave the president some optimism that there's a potential here for a major breakthrough with Kim Jong-un. And I think that's why you hear the president talk about there may be a dramatic breakthrough. This could be a really big event that's coming. And he cautions that all the time. But if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out.
But Kim may look more like a rational actor when he's hugging the leader of South Korea right now. But it wasn't that long ago that he was threatening to, you know, fire missiles at Guam.
Oh, well, it wasn't that long ago that he was talking about killing Americans and raining death on American right. cities. That was last year. So what I think is that this has a different feel to it, because in the last 90 days, Kim Jong-un has done everything that he can to pull out all the stops to drive towards a meeting with Mr. Trump based on what he says is his desire to denuclearize for the safety and security of North Korea in exchange for that, and obviously the removal of the sanctions. All that said, I mean, we're a long way from achieving that, because when we get into that meeting with him, the United States position is unequivocal. It's complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, not partial. The United States does not want this to take several years to do, where Kim could drag this out and maybe get some sanction relief and also hold on to a couple of weapons at the end of that. But we're not going to put up with any of that.
I want to ask you about Syria, because you've been writing about it. You supported the president's decision to strike the Assad regime after the suspected chemical attack, but you said those strikes were not sufficient and you want more aggressive U.S. military action in Syria. What are you proposing?
Well, I mean, just dealing with chemical weapons, I thought the first strike was insufficient. In other words, when Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons last April, we had a very proportioned, measured response. I think we should have taken down his air delivery means, which was resident at 6 airfields, and we could have done that all in one night, take down his air power infrastructure. And this time we came back with a—and that was a deterrent strike. In other words, so our audience understands, we were using that strike, measured and proportionate, so that he would not use chemical weapons again. A year later, because they had military value to Assad, and that's his pattern of behavior, he did it again.
Right.
So obviously the first strike didn't work, and the second one was another measured, proportionate strike. I felt we absolutely should have done what we could to cripple his war machine, particularly all of his air power infrastructure on the second strike. So, yeah, I think it's insufficient. As to the larger issue with Syria, the United States really doesn't have a strategy dealing with Syria beyond ISIS. When I look at the problem, I think we have to know where we are right now. We squandered many opportunities to be in a much better position than we are now. Russia and the Iranians have successfully propped up the Assad regime. That's just a fact. And we have to recognize that.
And you think Assad needs to go, by the way, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But we have to put a strategy in place, and it's a long-term strategy to achieve that end. What we could do is we've driven ISIS out of eastern Syria. We still have some more work to do there because there's 2,003 ISIS fighters still left there. And when I say eastern Syria, I mean east of the Euphrates River Valley. And what we should do is use that as a base of control, a control zone. Clear ISIS out of there and tell the Russians and the Iranians and the pro-Assad regime, stay west of the Euphrates River Valley. Don't come east of that, or you're going to be subject to be interdicted.
Is that going to require a lot of American troops, though?
No, it would not. I mean, Ambassador Bolton, the new National Security Advisor, at least is reportedly open to the idea of talking to the Sunni Arabs, our regional Sunni Arabs, in helping us with this problem. And they would be hopefully willing to put some troops in that area there to help provide security for that control zone. They would likely ask for U.S. leadership, and I think that would be appropriate. But no, we're not asking for a lot of troops there. What we are trying to do is build a Syrian Arab force, not a Syrian Kurd force, in that area. And that would begin to give us some leverage dealing with the Assad regime. I also think, although we've squandered much of the opportunity, the Syrian moderates are still in southern Syria. And we could begin to reinitiate an aid program to them in terms of weapons, et cetera. We've got to recognize that what the Iranians are about here, they run the war in Syria. And they run the ground war. Their general, four or five of their generals have been killed doing this. And they do it through their proxies, the Hezbollah. And they're clearly conducting a military buildup in southern Syria to encroach on the Israelis. They really want to put in their covert missile and rocket bases like they have in Lebanon so that they can overwhelm Israeli air defense systems by attacking them from multiple directions. That is clearly their intent, and the Prime Minister of Israel is quite concerned about it, and he's not going to stand for it, and that's why he's conducting these attacks. But the regional Arabs have never, ever made a commitment to help us because we only wanted to use them against ISIS, and they've always seen the problem is Assad. So I do think there are still some things that we can do to gain some leverage, albeit limited leverage, to be sure.
But is there appetite for that right now? It sounds from what President Trump is saying like he would rather just pull the U.S. completely out of Syria.
And I'm disappointed by that because I think if you just walk away from Syria, what you've done is you've just turned this over to the Iranians and to the Russians who are in a political and military alliance. Syria will become the anchor point for the Iranians' domination of the Middle East. They dominate control Lebanon. They are dominating most of the control in Syria. They have huge political influence inside of Iraq. They began the civil war in Yemen. They toppled the government there, which was friendly to the United States, with a single purpose in mind, is to dominate and control Yemen. The United States has got to recognize that. We've got to form an alliance with our allies to counter that aggression. It doesn't mean that the United States has to provide the dominant amount of military force or the dominant amount of money. I don't think we should. I really think this is more up to the Arabs themselves, but I do think we have to provide some leadership to them. It's sort of like an Arab NATO that has been so successful in dealing with the Soviet Union's aggression post-World War II. I think it's as much political and as much economic as it is military.
Well, let me ask you then finally about the Iran nuclear deal, which the president seems poised to pull the U.S. out of. How does that play into this? Do you think that that would be a mistake if the U.S. pulls out of that deal? And how does it affect what's going on in the region?
Where the United States is actually right now, diplomatically, for weeks, we have been conducting a diplomatic effort with the United Kingdom, Germany, and France to fix the deal, to create a supplemental. What's on the table is simply this. One is a prohibition on ballistic missiles. Two is access to secret research military sites where we believe there's a possibility of technological advancement on nuclear weapons is actually taking place. And it's not part of the JCPOA or the so-called nuclear deal. The third thing deals with the sunset clauses. And the sunset clauses means in 2025, Iran can have a nuclear threshold capability, which means close to a nuclear weapon, and by 2030, they have a clear pathway to a nuclear weapon. The United States' position is we want to keep those restrictions on indefinitely and not have them sunset in 25 and in 30. Initially, the Europeans accepted the first two, and they collectively have pushed back on the third one. If the French come around on that, I suspect there'll be considerable pressure put on Germany and the United Kingdom. So that's where the...
But Iran would have to agree to that, too.
They'll do it regardless of whether Iran agrees. They'll come to Iran, put that on the table, and threaten them with renewing sanctions if they don't agree with it. Hmm. Iran has a choice at that point. They can walk away from the deal. But now they're walking away from the deal. The people that know this regime believe, while the economic benefit from the nuclear deal isn't as great as what the Iranians imagined it would be, it is beneficial to them, and it's likely they would stay in the deal because of the economic benefit to them.
That's retired General Jack Keane, who is now chairman of the Institute for the Study of War. General Keane, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, enjoy talking to you.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner is dead, according to President Trump in one of his tweets about this weekend's annual meeting of journalists in Washington. Every year, there's an often wince-inducing roast of the president. This year, President Trump did not attend. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders became the target of comedian Michelle Wolf.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies.
A play on the Maybe It's Maybelline ad there, referring to Sanders' eyeliner as Lie Liner. Was it the nail in the coffin of this event? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is in the studio today. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
Just some quick thoughts from you. With no President Trump there, Wolf's targets were women, Sanders or Kellyanne Conway, and their appearance. Do you think that made it more uncomfortable for people? You know, Maggie Haberman of The Times tweeted out she was impressed that Sanders didn't walk out. But then you had 1996, Don Imus talked directly to a stone-faced Bill Clinton about extramarital affairs. So it's happened before.
Oh, it's happened frequently. The whole point of if you are going to invite an actual leading-edge comedian into one of these dinners, the whole point is that the people in the room treat it like a roast. But now it's televised and has been for some years, and not simply on C-SPAN. Cable news sees it as essentially a free weekend programming. Suddenly you realize you have a broader audience. So you're watching correspondents and anchors and executives having to decide. You're watching it play out on their faces in discomfort, having to decide whether, A, they think something is funny, and B, whether they want to be seen thinking something is funny. And so she's doing clearly at times quite profane, provocative roast. But I didn't think that the things said here were much more sharp-edged than things said in years past.
Well, she went after the left as well. She said Democrats. She said it's hard to go after Democrats. They don't do anything. And CNN, she said, the most useful information on CNN when Anthony Bourdain tells me where to eat noodles. But others have said Donald Trump has said far crasser things about women. So it's a little hypocritical. But bottom line, do you think it's dead?
I think it's really a question of this is the age of Trump. First off, I think it's valid to question whether these things have outlived their purpose in this realm. They want a slightly outrageous, cutting-edged figure because they want to draw celebrities. They want to draw people to come. It raises money for the scholarships they do. It helps fund the association itself. And they raise some, shall we say, auxiliary awareness to questions of the First Amendment and reporting. Right now, you have an administration that's not having tension with reporters doing their constitutionally defined role of holding government officials officials accountable. You have them in open rhetorical warfare and Trump trashing the very idea of reporters holding him accountable. So, this is a spectacle that has degenerated into a farce, that has degenerated into, a Mobius strip. The president and the administration has justified things that he has said to such an extreme that what Michelle Wolf did, as offensive as some people legitimately may have found it, doesn't even compare.
Well, but briefly, David Fogelman, by the way, many don't attend. The New York Times stopped attending in 2008. But if it's canceled now, wouldn't that be seen as acquiescing to a president who's questioned First Amendment rights and the rights of the press?
Well, I don't think a dinner has to be canceled. I'm not even sure that this version of it has to be canceled. I just don't think it works in the current form. I think Trump wants to be able to find a victory. This is an entertainment realm in which he's made it a question of himself versus the press once again. And if the White House correspondence is designed in a different way, that's understandable. But he'll take it as a notch in his belt.
David Fogelman, thanks.
You bet.
You may have heard our recent profile of the classical musician Betty Hauk, who gave up her career as a violist because she was going deaf.
I completely turned my back on music. I didn't want to have anything to do with music whatsoever. If I couldn't play up to the level that I was used to, I wasn't going to do it.
Hauk is 72 and has moderate to severe hearing loss that was likely caused by decades of exposure to music. She had to retire because the music didn't sound right to her anymore. She couldn't hear the high notes. It's impossible to replicate how she experiences music, but we asked the audiologist Marshall Chasen to help us out. He works in Toronto with musicians who've lost their hearing, and his son Sean Chasen is a composer who created what you're about to hear. The first third of Chasen's composition is how a song might sound to a person with healthy ears. The middle third is how the same song might sound to someone with hearing loss that's roughly equivalent to Betty Hauk's. And the final seconds are what hearing is like for people who suffer from tinnitus, or ringing in the ears. If you get knocked out, just try again. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with Marshall Chasen.
Dr. Chasen, welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
We heard the story of a musician who lost her hearing, and it ended up destroying her career. But, if you look at a list of musicians with hearing loss, the names are huge. You got Sting, Ozzy Osbourne, Neil Young. And here's Eric Clapton speaking with the BBC earlier this year.
The only thing I'm concerned with now is being in my 70s and being able to be proficient. I mean, I'm going deaf, I've got tinnitus, my hands just about work. It's amazing to myself that I'm still here.
How common is it for musicians to suffer hearing loss like this?
Well, very common, more common than one would think. Hearing loss is not something that shows up after one day or even after one year. It shows up after 20 or 30 years of playing or being exposed to loud noise or loud music. And usually it's painless. There's no outward sign. Your ears don't bleed, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's usually your friends and your family that might notice it long before the individual does. You might hear some ringing or tinnitus in the ears. When it gets a little bit more significant, you can hear pitch perception problems. So let's say you're trying to play C, but you hear it slightly flat as a B or B flat. Mm. Both the ringing in the ears and the pitch perception problems can be career threatening. But until that happens, many musicians don't realize they have a hearing loss.
I mentioned some of those names. They're very recognizable names, famous people. But there is this Finnish study that I've seen that showed 15% of classical musicians that researchers followed had permanent ringing in the ears. And that's compared to just 2% of the general population. So, this is not just for old aging rockers.
No, this is for all ages. In fact, you've hit on something very interesting in that it turns out that classical music is actually more damaging than rock and roll.
Really?
I know it sounds counterintuitive, but if you think about it, it makes a little bit of sense. A rock and roller might pick up their guitar on a Friday night gig and may not even practice or touch their music for another week or two until the next gig. In contrast, a classical musician plays 4 or 5 hours a day practicing. They may teach 1 or 2 hours a day, and then they have 4 or 5 or maybe 7 or 8 different performances every week. So even though the spot intensity might be greater for a rock and roll set, if you take the dose that they get, the number of hours per week of playing for a classical musician, it's much, much greater. There are other reasons as well. It turns out that if you dislike the music, it is more damaging to your hearing. And
really, what do you mean?
These data have been around since the early 70s. We're not too sure of all the reasons, but we do know that when you're disliking something, you have a higher stress level. And believe it or not, the biochemistry of the ear changes, and it makes you slightly more susceptible to hearing loss. It's called glutamate ototoxicity.
Doctor, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Why are you connecting, or are you connecting, classical musicians with this?
Classical musicians not only play more hours a week than a rock and roller, but many classical musicians play in an environment that is not ideal. Usually they have no choice over the selection of the music. Depending on the environment they're in, there may be some labor relations difficulties. Hmm. You may turn around and complain to the trumpet section. And in some cases, it's not unheard of that the trumpet section may play louder just because they're pissed off at you. In a rock and roll band, you usually play the music that you would like to play, so you're happy about it. So the whole labor relations issue and the stress that goes on in a classical venue is much, much more dominant and poorer than in a rock and roll environment.
So tell me about some of the work that you do with these musicians. How do you help them through hearing loss?
Well, there are many things that you can do, and it all starts when they're 14 years old, when they're in the youth orchestras, and you educate them about hearing loss being very slow and gradual and painless. You educate them that a damaging or a potential damaging noise is not all that loud. For example, a dial tone on a telephone is 85 decibels. Nobody in their right mind would think that a dial tone was loud, but it is. It's loud enough such that if you listen to it long enough, it would cause a permanent hearing loss from that sound. Since 1988, there are flat hearing protectors, that is, earplugs that a musician can use where it treats the bass note, the left-hand side of the piano keyboard, identically like the right side of the piano keyboard, the treble notes, such that music still sounds like music. Hmm. They can hear all the subtleties they need to hear, but it's taken from a damaging to a non-damaging level. And in fact, I've done some work with the Canadian National Youth Orchestra for many, many years where we supply them with hearing protection.
But once that hearing is gone, can you do anything to bring a back or help these musicians who must be going through a very emotional time losing their hearing, that, you know, their ears are so central to what it is that they're trying to do with their livelihood and as a form of expression?
Well, there's two answers to that question. The first is that, yes, there are some things that can be done. If I see a musician later in their career, for example, and they've been exposed to 20 or 30 years of noise or music exposure, and there are hearing aids now that are designed specifically for music. The two big things that you have to worry about, though, is the ringing in the ears, the tinnitus, and the pitch perception. Something sounds a little bit flat. Having both of those things can be career-threatening.
Yeah.
So if we can minimize hearing loss, we can minimize the chances of getting ringing or tinnitus or pitch perception problems.
Well, I'll tell you what, similar problems in our industry, in radio as well. I mean, you've got the sound in your ear all day long. It starts to add up. Marshall Chasen, Director of Auditory Research for the Musicians Clinic of Canada. Thanks a lot for speaking with me.
Have a wonderful day.
What? And here's another oral story, A-U-R-A-L. It's about the sound of ocean animals and the sounds they live with. Researchers are recording daily life at some of the country's national marine sanctuaries. Molly Samuel of member station WABE in Atlanta reports.
20 miles off the coast of Georgia, there is a chorus of underwater animal life at Gray's Reef. The sound comes from underwater microphones.
We call them hydrophones.
Kimberly Robertson is the research coordinator at Gray's Reef National Marine Sanctuary. Here's one of her favorite sounds. The quiet, low grunts in the background come from an oyster toadfish. It kind of looks how it sounds. It has big bug eyes.
And it has this sort of scruffy old man beard, this little fringe that hangs down around its fat mouth. And it likes to hide under rocks.
Gray's Reef is one of 13 marine sanctuaries in the country. They're like national parks, but in the ocean. The reef has animals like coral, octopuses, sharks, and sea turtles.
It is an underwater national treasure.
Those popping noises come from a school of fish called cubbyu, and that crackling campfire sound, that's snapping shrimp. You can hear a lot of natural sounds at Gray's Reef. The other sanctuaries in the Ocean Noise Study off the Florida Keys, near Maine, and in the Gulf of Mexico are close to noisy shipping lanes, oil and gas development, or popular fishing spots. And even the sound of Robertson's small research boat sounds like this from the ocean floor. Noise in the ocean can be controversial. Some worry about the impacts now that the Trump administration wants to open up nearly all U.S. coasts to oil and gas drilling. Research elsewhere has shown that noisy seismic blasts caused whales to call to each other less often. Another study found that they killed some plankton. For this study, Robertson leaves hydrophones on the ocean floor for a month at a time.
It's a way to look at Gray's Reef and learn about it and experience it without our interference.
It's also a way to give people a little taste of life at Gray's Reef, since most won't ever get down there themselves to hear dolphins squeaking or all those snapping shrimp. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel.
T-Mobile CEO John Legere is promising that his company's proposed merger with Sprint will be good for customers and the country. Here he is on CNBC today.
Services are going to be broadened. Prices are going to go down. Speeds are going to go up. The 5G capability is going to be beyond anything that the United States has ever seen before. Jobs are going to go up from day one. And both companies.
As Legere makes his pitch, regulators will consider whether to approve the $26 billion deal. It would create the second biggest wireless carrier in the country, behind Verizon. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So these two companies have tried and failed to merge in the past. If this does go through, how big a deal would it be?
It's a pretty big deal. I'm looking at this along three dimensions. The first dimension is the wireless industry. You're talking about, as you said, the creation of what could be the second largest wireless carrier in the country. Second, on tech, this could have major implications for building out what you heard John Legere talk about, 5G technology. That's the next generation of wireless tech that could really revolutionize internet speeds and reliability in the U.S. And then finally, on antitrust, we're in the middle of an incredible flurry of mergers, especially in this industry. You've got AT&T and Time Warner, Verizon and AOL, and now T-Mobile hooking up with Sprint, or at least trying to, again. And, you know, every major phone carrier, it seems, is adding parts right now. And it's going to be very interesting to see if the government gives them the green light.
Well, that's the question. Would regulators be willing to approve this? This would leave just three major wireless carriers in the U.S.
Yeah, and this is a concern. This is something that I think the government's absolutely going to look at. It's going to attract scrutiny. And I'm not prepared to say that the government is going to block it or accept it. But I think this question here is really all about framing. So here's one frame. One frame is this merger reduces the number of carriers, full stop. It hurts competition, and so it should be blocked. It's just going to lead to more job losses, higher prices, everything we've been afraid of with big companies, compounded by the fact that these are phone companies, and so these prices are something we're going to see every single month.
Right.
But here's another frame. With this merger, we move from two major wireless carriers, Verizon and AT&T, to three. Now, that sounds like the industry is getting more competitive. That sounds like we're getting another company with the resources to build out this 5G tech that everybody's waiting for. So I really do think those are going to be the two frames that are going to dominate this story for the next few months.
Yeah, it's just hard to make that argument when you look at what happened with the airlines. Fewer airlines, and we've seen the prices go up. Now, we heard the T-Mobile CEO, they're making a lot of promises that speeds will increase, that prices are going to go down. Is it likely that consumers would notice the difference with a T-Mobile Sprint getting together?
Very possibly. As you said, just look at the airline industry. Look what happens when you have an industry that doesn't have a lot of competition. It follows as night follows day. You have, you know, less competition, which means that individual large companies feel like they can raise prices on consumers and consumers have nowhere else to go, or otherwise that they'll find ways to cut services. You know, in many ways, looking at airlines, you know, the price of tickets is really low on something like Kayak or, you know, Priceline if you're just searching for the lowest possible ticket. But then, you know, where does just this, you lose on service, you know? You lose on the fact that you have to pay extra for getting your luggage on. You have to pay extra, you know, to, like, go to the bathroom and things like this. So you could see the same sort of thing entering into phone contracts if that sector were less competitive as well. You could see these sort of gimmicks where people say, you know, it's only $15 a month to sign up for your cell phone, but then every single thing you do with data gets you an extra $20 on.
Well, and a lot of the focus of these companies, and I know this is the case with Verizon as well, at this point isn't just about providing you cell phone and texting and data, but really becoming an entertainment platform for you, almost competing with the cable companies.
That is exactly right. I mean, look at what AT&T and Verizon are doing right now. They're already the big two here, and they're not merging horizontally. They're not merging with other, you know, cell phone carriers. They're merging with entertainment companies. AT&T, for example, trying to pick up Time Warner, which owns HBO and a bunch of other cable networks. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see if this deal does go through and you have another major cell phone carrier. I would expect that this company would then look to add an entertainment property to compete again with AT&T and Verizon, which are trying to build not only horizontal companies, but also vertical mergers where you own both the distribution and the content, both the spectrum and the entertainment.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, talking with us about the proposed merger between T-Mobile and Sprint. Derek, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And this note today, we want to say goodbye, thank you, and best wishes to Rachel Finlayson, who's been our intern here for the past several months, been doing a great job. She's off to intern at Bain & Company before heading back to school at Brigham Young University. Robin,
yep.
She is fluent in Mandarin, as you know, and she did a great job producing our series on China's One Belt, One Road initiative.
I'm scared of Rachel, frankly. She's so magnificent. Rachel, we will always have our American Lakes series. Let's meet at one someday. Till then, best of luck.
Best of luck to you, Rachel. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.